I walked into a campaign office and I heard him giving the speech about this idea that there's nothing that's wrong with America that can't be fixed with what's right with America. And even today, 2 days after the presidential election that did not go in the way that I wanted it to, I still believe that to be true. And Bill Clinton offered this idea of service, community service in exchange for college tuition. Change your community while you're changing yourself. And I was like, that makes so much sense, right? Like, yep. Why haven't I never heard of that before? That needs to happen. And so I broke up with a boyfriend. I dropped out of law school. I joined the campaign. And in the biggest yada, yada, yada in storytelling, Bill Clinton ended up in the White House, and I ended up in the White House too, helping create the program AmeriCorps.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
We are recording this on the 8th of November. The US election has just finished. It has been quite a wild ride. I expect it to continue being quite wild. And your career started at a point where you decided to leave law school and join a movement. And I'd love for our listeners to hear a little bit about what that stepping off point was, because it did start a pretty remarkable career.
Yeah, well, the stepping off point was that I found myself in law school because I had listened to everybody around me telling me what my definition of success should be. You should be a lawyer. You should, you know, run for office. You should become a senator, right? You should like have this career in politics. Those are the people who solve the problems. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. It sounds sexy. It sounds like success to me. So I did it. And then I found myself in law school, and I was that student who got called upon on the very first day and asked question after question after question, like you see in movies, right? Where the old crusty professor asks the young student a professor until she falls apart in a puddle of tears and shame. Like that was me. And in fact, the professor was old and crusty. He was about 900 years old. And I just knew I was in the wrong place, right? It didn't work for everything that I didn't even know I was going to become. I just had this sort of organ failure rejection moment. And so I started dating a guy who was like the world's worst boyfriend. And I joke around that the world's worst boyfriend, because of course that's what we do when we're miserable, we make bad life choices. I joke around that he had exquisite taste in precisely two things. The first being obviously girlfriends, and the second being unknown presidential hopefuls from tiny southern states. And so for your international audience, at the time, this is 1991, George H.W. Bush had just won Desert Storm. He had a 91% approval rating, and the Democrats basically put up a sacrificial lamb, like this unknown Southern governor, this young guy that nobody expected to win. There were no electoral votes in Arkansas. Like, it was just, let's just get through this one and have a real race in 4 years. And then he came out of nowhere, and I walked into a campaign office and I heard him giving the speech about this idea that there's nothing that's wrong with America that can't be fixed with what's right with America. And even today, 2 days after the presidential election that did not go in the way that I wanted it to, I still believe that to be true. And Bill Clinton offered this idea of service, community service in exchange for college tuition. Change your community while you're changing yourself. And I was like, that makes so much sense. Right? Like, why haven't I never heard of that before? That needs to happen. And so I broke up with a boyfriend. I dropped out of law school. I joined the campaign. And in the biggest yada, yada, yada in storytelling, Bill Clinton ended up in the White House, and I ended up in the White House too, helping create the program AmeriCorps.
So this is a pivotal time. I remember those days like they were yesterday. And that's putting us in the right time. So much has gone on since then. I mean, everything from Al Gore, and we can talk about politics for a long time here, but you know, the way that Al Gore then moved through the ranks, and that partnership went on to be something very, very iconic. What were the things?
I mean, I will just say, Al Gore changed the vice presidency. He was the first vice president who had an office in the West Wing. right? So he actually went into the Clinton-Gore administration as much more of a partner than every other vice president before him. And then if you fast forward to George W. Bush and Cheney, I mean, Cheney rewrote the rules of the power of the vice presidency. So, you know, the Clinton-Gore partnership really was the beginning of a very different looking vice presidency.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you go into that idea of partnership at such an incredible level, I guess before that, the vice president's, from the outside, it looks like it was very much a role of interest, of helpfulness, but not really of partnership. Like it was more ceremonial than anything else. And that could be completely incorrect from my point of view.
It was certainly ceremonial. I mean, you know, the vice president was one heartbeat away, et cetera, et cetera. But the role of the vice president was to do a lot of sort of international diplomacy and really to shore up the election. So if you were somebody from the East Coast, you would pick somebody from the West Coast. If you were somebody from, you know, a progressive state, you'd pick somebody from a little bit more of a conservative state. It was really a tool of the political electoral system more than a tool of the governing system. And in the same way that the first lady always has a project to term, right? She has her project that she's going to care about, like healthy eating or say no to drugs or whatever the thing is. The vice president think about the vice presidents in history that you remember. Not many before Al Gore.
Nope. He really changed. And I remember seeing his documentary on climate and him actively working in the background, and it felt to me like he was banging his head against a brick wall trying to get this message across. And then but through that process and that grit that he had, just built a platform that allowed him to speak a lot more freely about this, and he hasn't stopped. And it's one of those reassuring voices that you always hear him talking about that topic, and you know that he is the expert in the field.
Yes. I mean, I don't know how reassuring it is for him to tell us that the world is heating up in the hottest year we've ever had on record. But yeah, it's he was one of the first real policy wonks in the office.
Yeah.
Obviously you can see that.
Tell me about what you learned in that time. I mean, this sounds a little bit trite. I've watched The West Wing end to end 4 times. My wife and I, somehow we go back to this every couple of years for some reason, can't explain it. What is it like in the West Wing, where the frenetic pace of all of the decisions, all of the information that's coming through, how does it work in order for things to get done? Because from the outside, it looks like a very, very busy place.
The West Wing is actually quite realistic. There were a lot of people from the Clinton White House who were sort of staff writers or consultants to the West Wing, and the sort of walking and talking and everything moving and everything changing. And I mean, I was Donna Moss. I was not very important. I was the secretary to the person who was important. I was the young advanced staffer. I mean, I definitely wasn't, you know, CJ Craig or Toby or anybody else. I certainly wasn't the chief of staff. But yeah, I was the young hopeful, came off the campaign trail and just like was the administrative jack of all trades. I did a little speech writing. I did a little advance work. I did a little bit of policy research. I found the 4 young people who sat next to the first lady during the State of the Union when Bill Clinton talked about the idea of national service and AmeriCorps and what we'd accomplished. And I had to find them and interview them and make sure they were all telegenic and photogenic and they had great stories and there was a diversity of stories and backgrounds. And I joke around that was actually the beginning of my career in executive search, was sort of finding people who would be the right people at the right time. But very much the frenetic pace and the having to work together and the idea that you get from the West Wing that there is never a smartest person in the room. Everybody actually can add something in. And when people stop adding in what they have to offer, the end result is worse. But at the end of the day, someone does have to make a decision. Right. And when that person makes the decision, you go out publicly all in lockstep.
If you look back on that time, given, and we're going to get into the rest of this part of your career now into search and the other work you do now, if you think about the 3 or so lessons that sort of still sit in the back of your mind every time you walk out the door in the morning, What are the things that you took away from that really incredible time?
Yeah. Number one, if it's to change, why shouldn't you be the one to change it? Right? Everybody has capacity. Everyone has agency. Everyone has a voice. And if you don't like the way something's done, get up and fight, right? Start doing something about it, because everyday people change the world. And I saw that over and over and over again in Washington, D.C. Number two, there is nothing and no one that you can't learn from, right? So every single person, regardless of where they came from, and again, I believe this today, we are 2 days after Donald Trump stormed the United States and people are shocked and appalled and they can't believe it, or they're jubilant and excited and they're foaming at the mouth for what's to come. And I still believe that there are people on the other side of the aisle from whom I can learn a great deal, in the same way that I think they can learn from me. And number three, that leadership, we get leadership wrong because we think leaders lead from the front. And I worked for a man in the White House by the name of Eli Siegel. I actually dedicated my book Limitless to him. He ran the 1992 campaign and he was a very successful businessman. He could have had any job he wanted in the administration. He could have been the ambassador to France, right? He could have had the cushiest, best job ever. And he wanted to run national service because he believed in youth. And he spent so much time barnstorming the country, meeting with governors, meeting with senators, meeting with local agency directors to learn from them and to figure out what they cared about and to bring them on board. And when Eli died, he died very prematurely of mesothelioma when he was in his 50s. There were 1,000 people at his funeral, and Senator Ted Kennedy got up at his funeral and gave the eulogy and said, "There are 1,000 people in this room, and every single one of you think that you're his best friend or his good friend, and every single one of you is right." Eli had a full page obituary in the New York Times, and yet people had no idea who he was, because he led from the middle always. And he made sure that he didn't have to get the credit in order to get the job done. And I learned so much about how you create partnerships and how you create movements by watching him revel in the excitement and the glory of getting the job done, knowing that the right people who needed to know knew that he was the guy who made it happen, but that he didn't do it just for ego.
It's funny how that is such a foreign concept to so many people. You know, when you see sporting teams, when you see people who operate in the military and you see the team jubilance of achieving an outcome, and even that extends to people on the sideline that didn't actually play an active role on the day, in the minute of that thing happening. And you hear reporters say, "Look, you know, how did you feel sitting on the sidelines?" I don't think you're asking the right question. Like, I'm ecstatic that we've achieved this together. Like, it's really something else that people don't seem to understand.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, when you see people get a Super Bowl ring, like, they give a Super Bowl ring to not just the starting players, they give a Super Bowl ring to all of the players, because those players are the reason that the starting players are better, because they played against them in practice, right? Like, they give it to the athletic trainers, they give it to the people who keep the field up, right? Like, we are all the sum, greater than the sum of our parts. And when we start to think that I alone can fix it, right, that I'm the person, I think that we lose a lot. We lose a lot of what makes us special. And I think it's why it's so important to always ask yourself, like, am I this important? Like, am I the only person who matters here? And if you are the only person who matters, then you're either not assembling a great team, or you're kind of micromanaging, or no one else cares about it as much as you. But I like to be I don't like to be the smartest person in any room. I don't like to be the most important person in any room. I like to be in rooms where I can actually learn and we can lead in, I don't think everything has to be consensus, right? Like, at some point you have to make a decision. You have to move forward. Again, in the West Wing, like, Jed Bartlett made a decision, move forward. When he said, "Next, what's next?" you knew the conversation was over and it was time for the next thing. My assistant once sent me a compilation of Jed Bartlett going, "What's next? What's next?" Because every time I'm like, "We're done with that topic. What's next?" Like, she's like, "I get it now," right? Like, you have to make a decision. You have to move forward. And sometimes that decision is unpopular, but leaders who make unpopular decisions that everyone is able to still walk in lockstep do it because they have led from the center, not just from the front.
That's it. 100%. And you moved into executive search some point after that episode. When you had thought about, and I imagine this is from what we can tell in the research we've done about you and your career, it feels like when you entered into executive search relationships with your clients, that it was a true partnership, because that instinct that you had built out through your time in politics very much was about, I need to make you as successful as a client as possible. And therefore, the ability for you to partner with a set of candidates was not, where's my Rolodex? Who can I bring into a room, have a conversation just to check the box to get the deal done? Because these careers and these relationships persevere for decades, potentially, after you meet them for the first time. So what was that foray into executive circs like for you? And what was that like to sort of forge those partnerships over time with so many people?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question, because I was particularly proud in executive search that we got just as much follow-on work from people who we consider to be quote-unquote failed candidates, right? The candidates who were in the candidate pool but who didn't get the job.
Right.
We got just as much work from people who were failed candidates who either stayed in leadership roles in their own organizations or who moved eventually into other organizations, but who enjoyed the process with us so much that they wanted us to represent their organization. Right?
Yep.
That's a really big deal, because a lot of people in the executive search world, if you've ever been to candidate through an executive search firm, you know, like, you talk to them and then they ghost you. You never hear from them. There's like not a lot of respect. There's not a lot of partnership that's there. And then we expect them to call us back when we have a different job, or we want them to hire us when suddenly they have a need. Like, partnership begins so far before you need that partnership. So I think that's the first thing. So I love that you asked the question the way that you did, but I'll go back and say I didn't actually learn how to be a good partner in executive search through politics. I know it now, but at the time I didn't understand it. Like, now I can go back and I can be like, oh yeah, I learned that lesson in the White House. I learned that lesson on the campaign. But at the time I didn't get it, because I went into executive search and I worked for one of the marquee firms, big firm, like best and brightest. They taught me how to do this work in the very best way possible. But I had a really hard time with the way that the business model of executive search was created. So the way that, just a quick overview of executive search, it's you get 1/3 of the first year's cash compensation for anybody you place in a position. And a lot of firms also say you also get 25% of the first year's compensation of anyone else who comes out of that search, even if you weren't hired to do that search, right?
Right.
So if you're thinking about a position, if I'm doing a chief strategy officer that's going to get paid $400,000 a year, I'm much more incentivized to help that organization find that senior person than I am to find somebody who might be a smaller organization, might really need the help, might really miss the money that they're paying for me to do this if they're only paying their person $60,000, right? So where am I incentivized to spend my time? It didn't feel right to me that the job that paid more for the fancier organization, for the more prestigious role, was actually easier and I was getting paid more for it. It didn't feel right. And I walked into my boss's office one day and I was like, there's a better way. And he was like, there's the door. Didn't work. Wasn't a good partnership, right? Because what I value and what he valued were not aligned. He was like, profits first, client mission second. And I was like, client mission first, the profits will come. So I started my own firm. And when I started my own firm, I was so geeked out about this new, faster, smarter, more integrity-filled way of doing the work that I marched right into my potential client's office, my beautiful PowerPoint. I was like, here's our logo, and here's our mission statement, and here's my picture, and my business partner's picture. And I was like, it was like 6 or 7 slides into it before I was like, oh, and by the way, here's our super geeked out way that we do this work that'll cost you less, and we'll make more money, and everybody will be happy, and yay. And I didn't sell any work. And I didn't sell any work because I never actually said the words, we find you the world's best candidates. And I didn't realize this until about 6 or 8 months into like trying to hustle and sell work. And we were selling a little bit here and there, like enough to kind of keep us going and give us a glimmer of hope, but not really enough to like grow. And I had a very good friend on a search committee, and he called me up after we finished the pitch. And I was like, we crushed this. We're going to get this. No problem. He's like, you didn't get the work. And I was like, well, why did we get the work? And he's like, do you find the world's best candidates? And I was like, duh, like that's table stakes. Of course we do. And he said, Laura, you never even said it. Every other search firm walks in and says, we find you the world's best talent. We find you the world's best candidates. Now, let me tell you how we do it. And what I realized in that moment was, now I can track back to politics, that if the person you're talking to doesn't understand, I feel your pain, right? Bill Clinton, I feel your pain. The person that you're talking to doesn't understand that you see them and that you know them and that you hear them and that you honor them, they don't care how you're going to solve their problem because they don't think you understand their problem. And so it wasn't until that moment that I was like, stupid. Like, of course. And then I walked in, I gave the same exact pitch that I had been giving for the 6 or 8 months previous. But right before I started, I said, we find you the world's best talent. Now, let me tell you how. And we sold 100% for the rest of that calendar year of what we sold, because it just came down to the person looking at us and going, they see me, they know me, they hear me, they are my partner. They are going to take my this problem that I have that's now a shared problem, and they're going to carry it with them until such time as our shared problem goes away. And that is partnership.
Yeah, that is 100% true. And it's funny that we often say the greatest accelerant to a partnership is a clear ask. And that's also an exchange, right? If you're able to say to somebody, this is how we solve the problem we think you've got, at least it opens a conversation to try and make this work.
Yes.
If it is opaque in any way, you can't measure the time that is short enough for someone to look at their watch and just go, I don't think this is going to work, right? Like, I think for everybody listening, if you are dancing around the ask or the need, please prioritize everything to get that as short and sharp as you can so that you can just get down to the business of a modern partnership, which is helping to make people successful and help make them money.
I literally had a conversation with somebody yesterday who I don't even still know why we were talking. I think he was trying to sell me his services. Maybe he was trying to ask me for advice about who would use his services. Maybe he's just trying to tell me about his services because he thought I'd just be interested that he offered those services. And multiple times during the call, I was like, I don't understand what we're doing here. Can you what is the need that you have that you think I might be able to solve? Like, I asked him that question multiple times, and he should have just said, I need more business. I think you might be a good client of mine. Or he should have said, I don't know how to sell to people like you. Tell me what you're hearing and help me create my pitch. Like, we spent 40 minutes on the phone, and I was finally like, well, okay, I guess send me some information about you. That person will never do any work for me because they're not even helped. Like, help me give you my money.
That's it. That's exactly right. And I get being nervous about that, but I think we're in a day and an age now where you can be a little bit vulnerable. You can be clear, and you can ask for that help, because if you do, it's not a pitch. It's just the request for help. And I think the irony would have been that person probably would have sold you ultimately if that conversation would have continued.
And it was a super warm introduction. Like, I was talking to him because somebody who matters a lot to me, who I want to keep happy, asked me to talk to him, right? Like, it was the warmest possible introduction you could have ever had. And yet he fumbled the ball.
Yeah.
Like, on the 1 yard line, he fumbled the ball.
I get that. Now, let's talk a little bit about the research that you've done and the Limitless Leadership Report, because there is a set of really important questions you've asked a number of times. Last report, 2022, I think it was, that was published, and where you're undertaking the same research again now, which we will link to in the show notes. We're keen for people to participate in that. Tell me about the questions you're looking to answer, because when I walk through those set of questions, there was a very clear connection between the idea of what talent is trying to tell the market they're looking for. And there's also a message coming back from the people who are doing the hiring around, ultimately, how do we partner to create really fantastic employee-employer relationships? So tell me a bit about the origin of that research and why is this so important?
Yes. So the book before this past book that I wrote in 2019 is called Limitless. And it's based around this idea that when I was in executive search, I would call thousands of people, and because they were super successful at what they did, I wanted to recruit them away on behalf of my clients. I would call thousands of people because of this success. And much to my disbelief, none of them were very happy. So they all called me back, right? These are people that are in C-suite positions. They're super successful where they are. They are on paper incredibly great. Like, their lives should be perfect. And yet they were all calling me back. And I was so interested about this question of why. Like, why doesn't success equal happiness? Because it had everything we are told is that as soon as you get successful, right, you get into the C-suite, you're a leader, everything's great. It turns out that it's not And what I came to understand is that it's not actually about success as written by someone else. This idea of me going to law school, being a lawyer, didn't work for me. And I looked at my career, dropping out of law school, going to the White House, leaving the White House in the middle of the administration, right? Nobody does that. Going to the big firm, leaving the big firm. Nobody does that. Starting my own firm and then eventually selling my firm to the women who helped me build it when we were at the top of our game. Nobody does that. Why? Because I was successful, but I wasn't in consonance. I wasn't in alignment. I wasn't in flow. What I came to understand is that there are four things that everybody needs in some amount at some age, at every age and at every life stage. And they're calling, connection, contribution, and control. So calling, this gravitational force that gets you out of bed in the morning, the business you want to build, the partnership you want to create, the family you want to nurture, the mission you want to serve. Connection, does your work on a daily basis actually get you closer or farther to serving that calling? Contribution, does the work you're doing actually contribute to the life you want to live, the values you want to manifest, the career trajectory that you'd like to have, the money you'd like to make? How does this work contribute to you? And then control, how much personal agency do you have over how much that work connects to your calling or contributes to your life? And so along these four verticals of calling, connection, contribution, and control, we asked a set of questions. And it's at limitlessassessment.com. It's a fairly intense report. It takes about 15 to 18 minutes to take. But at the end of it, we came out with a whole lot of data, like 3 million bits of data about what actually drives people for engagement in their work and at home. And I to be totally honest, I make my living with words, not with numbers. And so I put this very complicated assessment out in December of 2018, right before the book came out in April of 2019. And then I didn't look at it again. I did like 150 podcasts. I talked about it everywhere. And then I opened it up and I was like, oh my God, there's 5,000 responses and it's super complicated. And I don't even know how to parse the data. And I closed it. And then the pandemic happened. And I listened to a whole bunch of blowhards who don't know anything talking about why people are unhappy. It's the pandemic. It's people are unhappy. They're disconnected. They're at home. They want to make more money. And I'm like, well, maybe that doesn't comport with my 20 years of anecdotal information. And God, I wish there was some data that somebody had that could actually prove out what I know to be true. And then I was like, oh yeah, I created this assessment. So I opened up the assessment and during the pandemic, I taught myself how to do regression analysis and to create pivot tables in Excel. And I realized that we have nearly 10,000 responses from 74 different countries across every industry and every demographic. And out of that, what we found was really interesting information. Like it's not just millennials who want a gold star for showing up. It's not just Gen Xers who want to feel like they matter. It's not just boomers who want to be relevant. In fact, purpose matters to almost every single one of us. Almost every single one of us wants to work for a leader who inspires us, but only about a third of us actually do. All of us want to work in a place where we want to emulate our coworkers, where we respect the people that we care about, but not a lot of us do that either. And also, you know, it's very obvious that bad leaders bleed out good people. Like, we know that to be true. So we focused our research specifically on people who self-identify as working for a quote unquote good leader. They've done the training, they get good results, et cetera. And what we found was that people who say, I work for a good leader, but I don't have a relationship with them, right? There's no partnership with them. They are just as likely to leave as somebody who says, I work for a bad leader. So what we found from it is that being seen, being cared about, being valued as a human in a workplace matters to everybody. And it's not just something that we can assign these, you know, trite generalizations just about any individual demographic.
That's fascinating. And just to be clear, so this was done, like the research, these responses you had were essentially pre-pandemic.
Well, so and we have 10,000 responses now starting in December of 2018. And right. We've been running this assessment ever since. So we have responses from before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and now as we've come out and after the pandemic. And everybody who tells you that the great resignation or quiet quitting is all because of the pandemic, they're wrong. Because on every single possible crosstab you can look at, people were in exactly the same place before the pandemic as they are now, except for one specific area, and that's control. So during the pandemic, everybody started working at home and all the bosses were like, do whatever you can to just keep the lights on. Like, just survive. Just right. do whatever's mission critical. Work where you want, how you want, when you want. Just get the job done. But only the stuff that actually really matters and everything else, just don't worry about it. And suddenly workers got a ton of control to be able to actually do what they wanted to do and to figure out when and how and where they brought the very best of them to work. And so every single metric stays exactly the same, but control, there was a 20% increase in how much control people wanted and how much they needed coming out of the pandemic. So that's pretty easy for bosses to say, well, I used to manage by walking around and seeing you working, which, by the way, just because you see people type into, they're not working, right? Like, that doesn't tell you they're actually doing anything. Like, my executive search firm that I ran for 15 years was fully virtual. And I founded it in 2002. So it was virtual before it was like COVID cool, right? Like, we were a fully virtual firm. And everybody was like, well, Laura, how do you measure the quality of your team's work? And I was like, are you sitting down? Are you ready? By the quality of my team's work.
Mind-blowing.
Yep. It's pretty simple, right? Like, what are the metrics? What are the measures of success? What is the project you're trying to complete? How will you know that you completed it? And how will you know you completed it well? Be exceptionally clear about that from the start. Over-communicate about that in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. And everyone will know where they're going. And they will all get it done. And they will feel like they are part of the process.
Can I double-click onto something you just said before about a good boss, but don't have a connection?
Yes.
So what would you be saying if you were sitting in front of a whole bunch of the employees or the leaders, the managers, to help solve that for people? Because at a human level, I've always found there's a few things that you can do to try and bridge a gap. And I don't know who else does this by default, but it's things like know when the person's birthday is, know if the person has children or not, understand if they have aging parents or not. Understand one thing about them, which is completely disconnected from work. And this is not about, you know, geeking out and having an invasive understanding of their life outside of work. This is just collecting a couple of bits of intelligence that in the corridor conversations at the beginning of the week, the end of the week, if you detect there's stress in the system somewhere with them, which in my experience, 9 times out of 10 is something to do with home, you can at least engage at a level which opens the door for a conversation. So
yes.
Tell me more about that. Like, how do you yes. think about that piece?
And also, to be clear, knowing if somebody that works for you has children, if they have aging parents, that is a pretty low bar, right?
You
That's
bet.
A pretty low bar. Mm-hmm. I once did an executive search for the CEO of one of the largest banks in the United States. And I was helping him find somebody to run his family foundation. And he said that he starts every Monday morning by writing a thank you letter to somebody who works for him. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, how do you find something to say every Monday morning? He looked at me and he was like, Laura, he says, I have 1,000 employees. If I cannot find someone to thank once a week, I'm doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh,
love that.
Yeah. Like, you want to talk about a partnership, right? This guy looks at his employees, not as people who work for him, but as the reason that he's successful, the reason the company's successful. So the first thing I would do before I told people what to do is I would ask them to level set a little bit. And I would say, look, I don't know anyone out there who would say, like, I'm a bad leader, right? So, like, most people think sure. they're pretty good at it. They think they're pretty good. So I would ask them, ask your team, do they feel empowered to ask for feedback? Do they have agency or influence about how they work? Do they have an understanding about why their work matters, right? Like, ask them if they understand why what they do and the quality of what they do, how that affects the bottom line. We found in our research that less than half of all workers understand what the long-term goals of their company are. We found that less than half of all workers understand what they need to do on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis to get to those long-term goals. And we found that less than half of workers also understood what they need to do themselves every single day to get their own work done. Right. So from the start, we should level set and just be like, before you try to like go out there and like tell everyone you're a good boss and create this relationship, like, let's figure out if you need to do a little work yourself. Now, once you've done that, I think it's changing the fundamentally most important thing you can do is yes, see your people as people, right? They are not just numbers, they're not just lines in the P&L. Like, they're humans and they have things going on. And I know it's super annoying to have to deal with your employee being like, little Johnny has an ear infection, I can't come in, right? But like, sometimes you just have to deal with that. Like people are human and they get it done. And either they're going to lie to you because they have to get it done, or they're going to be honest with you. And I think it's really important for you to understand what else is going on in the world. So I think that's absolutely fundamental. That's the start. But I think the second thing is changing your messaging. So for years, I used to run our corporate retreat, and we bring people in, all of our virtual staff from all over the world. And we'd rent out a whole, you know, inn, a bed and breakfast in like a hotel. And we would do, you know, the thing. And I would get up and I would give the State of the Union about, here's all the great things we accomplished this past year. And here's all the great goals for next year. And I would look at my team and their eyes would glaze over. And it would be, I mean, it was the most painful thing I did all year round. I hated it so much. And I remember I used to travel home from the retreat and I would just feel so drained. I would feel so incredibly drained. And one day I sent a text to my business coach and I was like, why doesn't this feel better? And he's like, well, first of all, the retreat's not for you, it's for them. And second of all, you should stop talking about the things that excite you. Mm-hmm. And talk about how it matters to them. So I can say to my team, we've grown 100% year over year for the last 6 years. And this year, I think that we can grow another 100% because we're going to do measure A, measure B, measure C. And they're sitting back there going, okay, how does this affect me? Will I still have a job tomorrow? Yeah. Do I get a role in measure A, measure B, measure C? Like, you're so busy talking about the big stuff. And it's like Charlie Brown, like in the teacher going, wah, 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 wah. They don't hear anything because all they're thinking about is, yeah, but like, good for you, but how does this affect me? And so if you're a leader and you can't break down all the exciting things that are happening and your big long-term strategic goals and your big long-term strategic rewards into what's actually going to matter to and for your people, you got a little more work to do as well.
Yeah, that's it. And the way you're talking about this, it's very clear to me that you value trust as a very material part of a relationship. Where does that come from for you? Because there's a lot of people that find themselves in particular industries that, look, let's be honest, that they either think the trust is a good thing, but they do pay a bit of lip service to it, or they believe wholeheartedly that trust in a partnership is the quintessential building block. And that is just almost a DNA bolted in trait. Where does that come from for you? What was in your experience that made that so pronounced?
Oh gosh, that's a deep therapist question question. Let's see. I think at the end of the day, I come from a world of politics where you make a stand about an issue and you do it publicly, right? You can't hide in the dark. You have to talk about what you care about, and people are going to love you for it or they're going to pillory you for it. And I think there have just probably been a lot of friendships forged in the fire of maybe taking unpopular sides of opinions sometimes. Even like, you know, it's the right thing to do, right? And Martin Luther King says, what, like, the arc of justice is like, the arc is long, but it bends towards justice, or like whatever that expression is. And I think, or here's an even better one, right? You very rarely get to sit in the shade of the trees you plant, right? And sometimes you have to plant trees that people aren't going to like you for planting. And you make some other friends with other tree planters that are out there. Wow, that's really butchering that expression. but you understand what I mean. So I think it comes from that, like, okay, are you with me? Like, do you get this? Are we, like, no matter what happens, we're like ride or die in here? Yeah. And as an entrepreneur, running a business, having people who work for me, I think, you know, you also just get burned a lot, you know, like, what leader hasn't gotten that email with the subject line, got a minute, or like, catch, like, want to catch up, right? You get that, like, hey, can we talk? And you're like, oh, crap. And you know, the person's going to walk in and they're going to tell you that they're taking a new job. And they're going to be like, yeah, but I'll give you 6 weeks notice. And you're like, yeah, but you've already been like out to lunch for 6 months because you've been looking for another job. And I knew something was up and you just didn't tell me. Right. Yep. And if we could have just had the conversation about why you were unhappy or what you were trying to do or where you want to eventually go, there might have even been better opportunity here. But no, you lied. You kept it to me. And it just feels like a betrayal, right? So this idea of just honesty. So now when I hire somebody, I'll say to them, look, I'm hiring you for this job. And if you're in the same job in a year, like the same exact position, doing the same exact thing. And it's not by your choice. Cause I've had people who wanted to sort of stay where they are because of other things going on in their families. But like, right. if you're in the same job doing the same thing day in and day out than you were a year ago, not by your choice, then I have failed you as a leader. So I want to have an active, constant conversation about your interests, about your growth, about what you want to be doing. I don't want it to be my problem when you decide like, I'm leaving and I'm leaving, you know, I'm leaving you in the lurch. So like we will constantly be collating and codifying what the job is so that we can replace you. But like, yeah, I owe it to you to move you along a process of your career growth.
I love that because there is, as Brené Brown says, you know, clear is kind and unclear is unkind. And yes. it's a two-way street, right? We've got employees who need to feel, or team members that need to feel able to be able to have that conversation with you. But man, does it start on day one? It is a really yes. important sort of habit and ritual for them to walk into, no matter how unfamiliar it feels to them, because they might not have seen it in other employees' employment relationships before.
Well, it actually starts before day one, because it starts in the recruiting process. It starts right. when you talk to people about, well, tell me how you grew in the last position that you were in. Talk to me about the conversations you had with your boss. It starts during the reference checking, where you talk about how did that person leave you when they did eventually leave you, right? So it's learning how that person operates in difficulty. It's asking questions like, do they know when to ask for help? And when they ask for help, how do they ask for help? Was there ever a time when they should have asked for help sooner than they did, and what happened? And you can find out, like, do they lie? Do they cover up? Are they trying to point fingers at everybody else? So there's so many things that we can learn about people from the way that they behaved in a previous employment relationship that help inform. We also might hear things like, well, you know, I know that they didn't leave that last job well because nobody leaves that boss well. And I'm here to tell you, as somebody who worked alongside them, that the fact that that boss isn't giving them a reference is actually not a bad sign for them. That's actually just that boss is like that. So, you know, they're coming in with a little bit of PTSD maybe, and they don't know right. if they can trust their boss. So it gives you really a lot that you can learn about how to manage that person in this role.
You mentioned earlier about this idea of you look back on your career, particularly in the search world, where you had, it dawned on you, of course, this is the way you should do this and the way you present, the way you pitch in order to form those partnerships. Tell me about how you've seen, given the thousands of conversations you've had, how you have seen this idea of people partnering together, organizations partnering together, how that's evolved over the last, you know, 20 plus years from the point of which you came out of politics, done all this amazing search work. Then you've gone into a lot of this advisory work and building all these organizations, the memberships you have to these networks that you've built or are part of. How has your point of view changed on the role of partnership and actually getting things done and moving the needle on different things?
Yeah, I think that it used to be that you would hire an expert in something in particular. They would do that one job for you, then that would be it, right? Mm. Like it was, there were a handful of big names, a handful of big consulting firms. You would hire them for a project. And then, you know, no one ever got fired for hiring IBM, right? You hired like the big name and you could cover your ass. And I think what's changed is that people have created relationships with people that they trust, a lot of times from following them on social media, following them on LinkedIn, following them even on Instagram, TikTok, whatever. But watching them for a long period of time and seeing their intelligence demonstrated around a multitude of ideas and subject matter areas. Yeah. So they can see their expertise that's sort of cross-pollinated. And so they bring in people that may not be like the big name, but somebody who they actually know and they trust even before they invite them in to have the conversation, that initial pitch conversation. Yeah. You know, you've been pitching for years and you don't even know it, right? Like I get so many people who call me up to give a keynote. They're like, oh yeah, we've been watching on social media for years and the topic of the event we're having aligns with what we love hearing you talk about. So I'm like, great, terrific. I don't even have to pitch them, right? They've seen it. They've seen excerpts of my keynotes. They know, or they've seen results of my research. So I think that's the first thing is that it's no longer just the big names, and it's sort of there's never been a time where access is more sort of little d democratized for everybody to put their intelligence out there. And I think the second thing is that I think we hire people who we trust and we allow them to figure things out along the way rather than hiring just I'm not talking about brain surgery. Like you're not going to hire like a football coach to do your brain surgery or a brain surgeon to coach your football. But I think that we are more comfortable with people being generalists and coming in to sort of do deep research, understanding that there are translatable skills and transferable skills. Transferable skill is you've done this work before, you'll do it again. You are Accenture, you are Deloitte, you're coming in to do exactly like everything's a nail because you're a hammer. And then there's translatable skills where you understand research, you understand analysis, you understand stewarding relationships, you understand how to make the ask, you understand how to move people within an organization, you understand change management. And that's transferable to lots of different places and lots of different moments. And so I think the two things that I would say are there's more space for smaller players, and there is more space for longer, deeper, broader relationships.
I love that. You do a lot of work in the not-for-profit impact sector. When I look at the interests you have, they've been broad and deep for a very, very long time. There's a lot of different causes that we can all be involved in. There's just too many for any one person to get their arms all the way around. What are you most interested in when it comes to impact and social causes?
Oh, gosh. I'm a big believer that root problems are important to solve. So I think, yes, I care about climate. I care about gay marriage. I care about reproductive rights. I care about all the like insert progressive things here. Sorry to any of your more conservative listeners. But I care about those things, obviously. But I think at the root of why we are losing access to those things is because there are a lot of communities in the United States that have lost access to voting, right? We have lost access to civic education. We have downgraded the importance of civic leadership, civic involvement. And so for me, I think, you know, there are some massive root problems that we need to solve. We need to create much more access to voting. We need to make the, you know, election day a holiday so that people don't have to take off of work, which of course, you know, harms people who are shift workers, right?
Like, yeah.
So there are just a lot of things that need to be solved. If we got rid of private sector prisons, for example, then the private sector prisons wouldn't be giving money to elected officials to create policies that, you know, stop and frisk and, you know, made it harder to, and then as soon as you go to prison, you lose the opportunity to vote, right? And like, who does that greatly affect? Black and brown people. So like, there are some massive issues around access to be able to actually create change that are at the root. You can give all the money that you want to some of the ways that they manifest and the burning fires we have, but I think there is this underlying low grade that is, you know, fight that was started in the late 80s to start restricting access to voting that we are seeing the long tail of now.
I mean, you seem to partner with a bunch of other women and other leaders to affect that change. Is that, you know, when you think about campaigning, you think about bringing people together to drive in the same direction. Is that something that you just do instinctively, or is it something that you've sort of honed over time?
I mean, I'll work with women, I'll work with men, I'll work with anybody. I would be more than happy to partner with men too. I think that's something that Eli taught me, Eli Siegel, in the White House. That was something that, again, it was a lesson I didn't know that I was learning at the time. Even actually in the same way, I ran into him about 10 years after, and I had started my own company, and he was like, "Did you always know you'd be an entrepreneur?" I knew you'd be an entrepreneur. And I was like, "I didn't know. I wish you told me." I was like 22 years old. I didn't know anything. and you know, I'm 53 now, and still there are lessons that I learned that I'm like, "Oh, that's what Eli was doing." Right. So I think watching him, I mean, when Eli barnstormed the country to get national service passed, national service was probably the last great bipartisan bill that came out of Washington, D.C.
Right.
And we had support from Republicans. We had support from Democrats. He had Democratic governors. He had Republican governors. It was a completely bipartisan bill. And that was because he started with relationships with humans and not with labels.
Right.
And I think that's super important to do. I mean, like I said, I'm not just working to get more voting access for Democrats. I'm looking to get more voting access for everyone.
Everybody.
I think it's super important that everybody has a vote. I think it's super important that we teach civics education in our country so people understand that they have a voice that matters. Like I think, and I'm not just saying like, I only want a certain percentage of people. I want everybody to have it. We should all be able to feel like government is happening with us and through us and not to us.
I love that. Laura, this has been a really, I could talk to you for days and days and days about this. It's one of those really deeply interesting topics, and not because it's US-centric, but because there is such a consistency of that around the world. Before we get into the rapid fire.
I do want to say, I think that that is because of a lack of understanding of partnership and people walking into relationships, knowing that everybody has something to offer and that we just need to like sit and actually listen to people to understand it. And when you feel like I had all the toys in the sandbox and now somebody else is taking my toys, you feel like you're losing something. Of course, that's when we get strongmen. And that's, like you said, is happening all over the world. So I do I love that you're doing this podcast because there has never been a more important time to have partnership. One of my closest friends is actually an evangelical Christian who lives in Oklahoma. And he's a straight cisgendered white dude who's like 6'4" and weighs 250 pounds. And he does not feel in any way threatened or concerned or worried in the way that I do today. But yet we text all day, every day, and we talk about politics and we listen to each other. And I understand where he's coming from. He understands where I'm coming from. And I think that that's super important.
Thank you for saying that. And look, this idea of holding the paradox between I can have one view, you can have another. If we find the overlap point, there is so much upside for both of us that this is not a zero-sum game. Because there is so much to achieve and collaborate on together. I'm deeply passionate about helping people understand that be good with the paradox. It might not seem on day one that there is an equal benefit, but there is certainly more than equal benefits coming to everybody involved if you decide to start walking down that path. It's just the ability to be resilient through that walk.
Yes. I mean, I posted on Facebook yesterday. I was like, listen, if you voted for the other guy, like, I will stop and I will smile and I will listen and I will see the humanity in you, just not today.
Yeah.
Right? So like, it's like, I'm not saying toxic positivity, like we should all love each other. I'm saying like, you can take some time for yourself and you can lick that's your wounds it. And that's okay. But like the only way forward is together, whether you like it or not, it is the only way forward.
I remember Jeff Weiner, who, when he was CEO at LinkedIn, he introduced a value at LinkedIn which went along the lines of, I have a genuine fear of missing out on important perspective. And it is the walking into a conversation and also walking out of a conversation with this mindset of, what am I missing here? That there's something that doesn't feel like it stacks up. And the minute you think that you've got it nailed is the time you need to ask yourself that question. And so I think this is one of those perfect times to really over-rotate on that piece. Just seek to understand and be curious. It's a super important step.
Yes, I agree. I agree 100%.
Laura, we're going to get into a rapid fire, which is one of my favorite parts of this conversation. Before we do, one last question for you. We know that there is immense power in partnership, in bridging divides, in exploring new places. What are business leaders missing about the power of partnership right now? Why aren't they doing more of it?
Oh, I think that leaders do a lot of talking. And I think that the closer you get to the head of the table, you're expected to have all of the answers. And I don't know whether it's bad role modeling or insecurity or imposter syndrome. I know from my research around my book, Wonder Hell, is that every single person who has ever accomplished anything that they didn't think they could do was riddled with imposter syndrome and doubt and anxiety and nerves and envy and exhaustion and burnout and all the rest. And so I think leaders are expected to have it all together. And so they do a lot of talking, which means that they don't do a lot of listening. And I think what leaders are missing out on in partnerships is being able to say, I don't know. Can you tell me more? That's really interesting. I'd like to hear more. So just like you were saying, curiosity. I think being more curious than being expert is the most important thing a leader can do.
I love that. All right. Are you ready for this rapid fire?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. All right. Five questions. First question. Complete this sentence. Partnership is...
trust.
You'd be surprised how often that comes up.
I would imagine it comes up a lot because, you know, trust is the most important thing. And how do you get trust? You get trust by listening, by honoring, by seeing. There's a million billion miles between loving somebody and truly seeing them for who they are and still loving them anyway.
We will pause for people just right now to look at the show notes of the episode you're listening or watching to right now. There is a link in the show note. And it is where you need to go and start doing the research that we just talked about before for the Limitless Report. Just do that. You can do two things at once. It's fine. Just keep listening, keep watching, hit that link and start that work now. Now, question number two, what content are you loving at the moment?
So I've got two kids in college and I am loving ridiculous TikToks of people dancing and singing and doing all sorts of Gen Z things because that allows me to actually talk to my kids and not seem like I'm an old fart who is completely disconnected. And the reason I'm loving that content and the reason I think anybody in partnership should love it is because you got to get yourself out of your own zone of genius and put yourself into somebody else's because it allows you to pick up on opportunities that you might not even hear them mentioning if you don't even get the joke.
I love that. I love that. What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
The worst piece of advice I've received is that I am super important and that I should say yes to all the things and I should do everything that I get asked to do because it turns out that you're not that important. And we often get asked not because we're the most important or the most well-researched or most sought out person. It's because we're the most proximate heartbeat. And so I always tell people that the hardest piece of advice I ever got was you're just not that important. And you got to figure out where you are that important and double down there instead.
Question four, when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Well, now I know because I lost so many pitches in executive search, the first thing I do is I ask them not how can I help, but what do you need? Right? What do you need? What would success look like for you? What needs to happen for you to feel successful? And they tell me what their problem is and what they need. And then I'm like, oh, it just so happens. That's exactly what I do. And then they're all excited and it's done.
Love that. All right. Final question. What's one thing you are deeply grateful for right now?
This is sort of a funny thing to say 2 days after our election, but I am deeply grateful for democracy because as Winston Churchill said, it is absolutely the worst form of government except for all the rest.
I love that. I love that. Laura, this has been such a pleasure. And I think this, we're going to have another follow-on conversation to this. It's been really something. Tell me once again where people can go to kick into this research and also to learn more about you.
Yeah, so I am Laura Gassner-Otting. All my friends call me LGO. So I'm at Hey, like H-E-Y, Hey LGO on all the socials. You can find me at lauragassnerotting.com and you can participate in the research at limitlessassessment.com. And if you do, I will tell you exactly what is disaffecting you, why you are disengaged, and you will get a long report telling you exactly what you can do either to change yourself, change your workplace, or change your career in order to find both success and happiness.
I love it. Such a pleasure. Thank you. And I can't wait for our next conversation.
Thank you so much, Phil. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.